With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. San Joaquin grape growers are struggling to get permits to burn diseased vineyards. Grape growers facing a January 1, 2025 deadline to end agricultural burning say they're having difficulty getting burn permits from the regional San Joaquin Valley Air Pollution Control District. Under a 2003 law, open-air burning of orchards and vineyard materials within eight county districts was supposed to be phased out by 2010, but that's provided that there were alternate, less polluting disposal methods available. However, several biomass plants that were expected to accept the agricultural material have closed. The California Air Resources Board approved extending the deadline to end burning. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Advocating for agriculture to protect family ag businesses. Every year, new legislation is proposed by lawmakers disconnected from agriculture that somehow have an impact on the California ag industry. However, when your livelihood is on the line, San Joaquin County Farm Bureau Director Andrew Genasi says stepping up to the plate shouldn't be too big of an ask.
And you know, I know it's a pain in the ass to get up to Sacramento. You got to take a day off or multiple days, depending on where you are in California. But isn't your operation worth it? Isn't your legacy worth that? I mean, you would spend a couple days on harvest. Why wouldn't you spend a couple days on protecting your ability to harvest? I don't understand the train of thought that allows you to say, I don't have time for that. Like if you don't have time to protect your operation, what do you have time for? I don't get it. But I know people are busy, and I know it's not easy to just walk away from your operation for a day or two. But man, I mean, if you're not willing to do that, then you better be prepared to walk away for the rest of your life and walk away from it for your family. Because if you don't protect yourself, your water rights, land rights, your ability to farm economically, you know, all these things are on the line, and we got to stand up and say something because, man, it ain't getting any better.
And now here's AgNet West Brian German with more Ag News.
Mating disruption has become a mainstream approach for addressing navel orangeworm in orchards, and part of the key to that success has been increased acreage where it's deployed. Entomology and Pest Management Advisor with UC Cooperative Extension in Kern County, David Havlin, explained how there's strength in numbers when using mating disruption in orchards.
So with mating disruption, the goal is to have a solid, contiguous plume of artificial pheromone so that no matter what a male moth does, he just can't get out of it. Now, in the case of navel orangeworm, it works by overstimulating their antennae. Gives them a really bad headache, if you want to call it that. So, you know, if you can give them a headache and maintain that really bad headache for their entire lifespan as an adult, it's going to be effective. So because of that, the larger the acreage that you're working with is the larger the area that you can have inside this contiguous plume, and therefore is the more effective that your main disruption program is going to be. To the contrary, if you have a really small area, you can have lots of both males and females on all sides of your orchard flying around, mating with each other, and then just flying into your orchard and laying eggs. You know, there's nothing about mating disruption that kills a pest. It just prevents them from being born. So the weakness is mated females flying into an orchard with mating disruption. The strength and the way to overcome that is to use large acreage so you're minimizing the borders with areas that mating disruption is not employed.
Next week, the U.S. Department of Agriculture will be hosting a virtual data users meeting. USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, in cooperation with the World Agricultural Outlook Board and other agencies, will be holding the biannual meeting on October 17th and 18th. The data users meeting is held to share recent and pending statistical program changes with the public and to solicit input on these and other programs important to agriculture. The October 17th agenda includes agency updates, followed by breakout sessions covering the 2022 Ag Census, AMS data visualizations, the use of weather information in the WASDE report, and a review of the NAS historical revisions and estimating program. October 18th will include an open forum for questions and comments from attendees, along with breakout sessions addressing the ERA feed grains database and understanding publicly available data from USDA's Risk Management Agency. More information about the 2023 USDA Fall Virtual Data Users Meeting is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, Minnesota farmer Harold Woolley took over as president of the National Corn Growers Association last week, looking to help thread the needle on Congress passing a farm bill this year. Commodity leaders such as Woolley are looking for Congress to take action to replace the farm bill that expired on September 30th. But right now, the House of Representatives is in turmoil. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy last Tuesday became the first House Speaker in history to lose his position. Talking with reporters on Tuesday, Woolley said his most immediate objective is to complete a farm bill with NCGA's priorities included in it.
Food security is national security, so that's why it's important that we have a reliable system of production in this country.
He says, we don't write a farm bill for the good times, we write a farm bill for the bad times.
We've just experienced a number of years of a very good time, and farmers have not used that farm safety net. You know, the federal government has not had to expend over the recent years any money in that farm safety net because we've had good years. And, you know, and that's certainly what farmers want. They want to get their income from the market. They don't want to get their income from the government. So, you know, we need a good safety net for when those bad years come so that we can maintain our system of production in this country that, you know, that we do a wonderful job with. We're very good at producing our crops.
So far, House and Senate Agriculture Committee leaders have not called on farm groups to rally around a specific issue or made a public push to get a new farm bill passed.
Those committee staffers are very secretive. They don't let us know exactly which way they're going. And there have not been any public asks of us as to how we might help move this forward. So, you know, we keep advocating with the individual members, and every chance we get to talk with those committee staff members, we're also advocating for our programs.
Along with completing the farm bill, he would like to see lawmakers support next-generation biofuels. Woolley points out airlines and biofuel makers are on board for a sustainable aviation fuel, which could drive demand for ethanol as the industry works to reduce its carbon footprint.
We work to get our carbon scores for our ethanol plants and our farms down. We will have ethanol with a low enough carbon score that it will be possible to do ethanol to jet. And that's a phrase I think you're going to hear a lot more in the future. Everybody needs to kind of get on the same page if we're going to make this happen. And there are a number of determined folks who want to see that happen, NCGA being one of them. So that's some of the things that we're going to work on as we work to increase the demand for our corn.
He also wants firmer footing for year-round use of E15, which right now relies on annual waivers from EPA. In other agriculture news, dairy markets are searching for momentum. Jenny Wackershower of Ever.ag, speaking at World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin, explains.
We are sitting in what we like to call the epitome of we need exports market. So traditionally in the U.S. marketplace over the last few years, exports have really driven when we've had a successful dairy market versus a struggle market. And as we sit right now, the European Union has grown their milk production similarly after COVID as the U.S. has. So we are competing with them every day for cheese. So as we need to entice those international buyers to come into the U.S. market, we tend to need to correct our price on cheese down to what the European Union levels, which has been 150 to 175 cheese. So in recent weeks, as we rallied up towards $190 to $2 cheese, that was great for the domestic market, but it took us out of competitive spot there on getting more exports to come in.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, sign up for a new USDA dairy program to assist producers who suffered economic loss due to a weather event will end October 16th. Rod Bain has more details.
Dairy producers, did you dump or remove milk from the commercial milk market due to a weather event in 2020, 21, or 22? Say, for instance, a weather-related power outage that created inability to properly store market-designated milk.
The milk loss program is a program that helps producers offset economic loss that they had who had no other choice but to dump their milk during disasters.
Farm Service Agency Acting Deputy Administrator John Burge says this new program provides compensation for producers who dump milk due to a qualifying weather event in any of the 3 years of eligibility.
Some of the qualifying disasters that we would take into account for this include blizzards, wildfires, hurricanes, derechos, excessive heat, and winter storms, a few others as well.
Eligible dairy operators have until October 16th to sign up for milk loss assistance through their local FSA office. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Thanks, Rod. And Farm Service Agency Acting Deputy Administrator John Burge has more information concerning how this new USDA dairy program pays producers.
It allows eligible dairy operations to get payments for the milk that was dumped due to a qualifying weather event. And this particular rule that we just adopted is for events in 2020, 2021, and 2022. And our sign-up runs through October 16th. Any producer that thinks that they had a circumstance where they had a qualifying weather event and they dumped their milk is welcome to come into our county offices and sign up for that program. There's a number of different items that are important to bring or important to submit when you're in the office. The county office can help you through all of that, but the form for the program is FSA 376, and our county office can walk you through how to fill that out.
Again, that was FSA Acting Deputy Administrator John Burge. Well, the National Dairy Farmers Assuring Responsible Management Program last week announced the launch of Farm Biosecurity Enhanced. The project is a new aspect of the Farm Biosecurity Program that includes training and an online database. Farm Biosecurity Enhanced includes an online database that's developed and securely stored dairy producers' enhanced biosecurity plans and an online training that helps users write those plans. Farm has also developed a Farm Biosecurity Enhanced Biosecurity Prep Guide and Database User Guide to complement these tools. They note that stronger or enhanced levels of biosecurity will be needed to protect cattle against the highly contagious foot and mouth disease found on two-thirds of the world. Now, one FMD case in the U.S. could shut down movement across the nation of livestock and their products for at least 72 hours. If you'd like to learn more about the farm program or access protocol templates and training aids, just simply visit the farm website, nationaldairyfarm.com. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Why do we have GMOs? Actually, we've been modifying crops for thousands of years to prevent crop loss from pest and weather damage, to grow more food on less land, even to improve nutrition. Today, GMOs are developed for the same reasons. With genetic engineering, scientists can change and improve crops more easily and quickly. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
One of the many regions of the world suffering a reduction in agricultural productivity is sub-Saharan Africa. Gary Crawford has more coming up in today's This Land of Ours report.
A new report from Virginia Tech University is sounding a warning that global growth in agricultural productivity is falling. The report's editor, Dr. Tom Thompson, says, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa,
with constrained access to productivity-enhancing tools, farmers are expanding agricultural land into wildlands at an alarming rate.
We hear now firsthand from a farmer in Zimbabwe.
Over the past few years, we have seen productivity drop. Climate change has made farming very, very difficult in Zimbabwe and very unpredictable.
She says many farmers in Africa are still using basically the same equipment, the same techniques, same crop varieties that were used 50 to 100 years ago. The new report says the reductions in ag productivity growth are not just happening in the developing world, but also in the U.S. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
And I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. For many farmers, crop insurance is a key element of an effective risk management strategy. Private companies sell and service the policies, but taxpayers subsidize the premiums. That means the public policy of crop insurance is a component of farm bill discussions. There's a current reform proposal on the table. A crop insurance reform proposal has been introduced in the U.S. House. Its purpose is to help smaller farming operations get additional crop insurance coverage, but its means for doing so is to eliminate premium subsidies for larger farming operations without providing additional coverage for smaller operations. The bill caps annual premium subsidies at $125,000 per farmer and eliminates them for farmers with more than $250,000 in adjusted gross income. The bill also reduces the subsidies to crop insurance companies, which is projected to reduce their profit from 14% to about 9%. In addition, the bill eliminates subsidies for harvest price option and requires the USDA to disclose who gets subsidies and the amount. It also restricts crop insurance to active farmers. The bill represents a dramatic change to the crop insurance program. There's not really anything in the bill to help smaller farming operations, and if the bill passes, all farmers would see an increase in crop insurance premiums. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen.
A new report from Virginia Tech University is sounding a warning that global growth in agricultural productivity is falling. The report's editor, Dr. Tom Thompson, says, for example, in sub-Saharan Africa,
with constrained access to productivity-enhancing tools, farmers are expanding agricultural land into wildlands at an alarming rate.
A rate not sustainable. We hear now firsthand from a woman farmer in Zimbabwe, Rumiso Mashumba.
Over the past few years, we have seen productivity drop. Climate change has made farming very, very difficult in Zimbabwe and very unpredictable.
She says many farmers in Africa are still using basically the same equipment, the same techniques, same crop varieties that were used 50 to 100 years ago.
So we're not investing enough in science, in research, to find out what are we going to do in the future or even right now.
The new report says the reductions in ag productivity growth are not just happening in the developing world, but also in the U.S. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
Consumers may expect to pay less for a Thanksgiving turkey this November thanks to improved supplies. Berndt Nelson, American Farm Bureau Federation economist, says prices have fallen since highly pathogenic avian influenza peaked last September.
Now, since then, biosecurity measures and the practices that we put in place, the programs that USDA has used, have helped avian influenza slow. We're well below where we were last year, so turkey numbers have had time to rebuild.
Nelson says the average price per pound is down 22% from last year.
Our average price at this time last year was around $1.63 per pound, and right now we're looking at about $1.27 a pound. Now that's for that 8 to 16 pound turkey that we use for a centerpiece for Thanksgiving. So that just kind of shows that we've had time to rebuild these supplies. Inflation isn't as big of a factor this year as it was last year, so turkey prices have had time to come down a little bit.
Nelson adds lower prices and higher supplies also means increased demand.
Per capita demand for turkey is expected to increase by about 6% this year to 15.5 pounds per person in response to these lower prices. So overall, farmers and consumers alike should receive some relief from turkey prices this Thanksgiving. We had very few avian influenza detections. In fact, June was the first month that we had zero avian influenza detections in the last year. And this means that there's plenty of turkey to go around for Thanksgiving this year.
Full details on the cost to cook a Thanksgiving feast for 10 will be released on November 15th. To read the Market Intel report on turkey prices, go to fb.org. Michael Clements, Washington.
The nation mostly continues to see very short to short topsoil moisture conditions. Rod Bain reports.
Dry conditions continuing, per the latest USDA topsoil moisture condition report. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says for the period ending October 1st,
55% topsoil moisture is rated very short to short, just 2% surplus.
Noteworthy about the area of wet conditions in that
small area of wet conditions is predominantly across the northern mid-Atlantic into southern New England.
Several states within the remainder of the nation, however, report at least 50% very short to short topsoil moisture, with regions of note including the Pacific Northwest, the nation's midsection, and parts of the southeast. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Unseasonably cool temperatures over a wide area over the weekend, lingering showers, and a crop report this week will keep support under the grain trade early, though there could be some retracement. I'm Mark Oppold with your bottom line report to start the week, brought to you by Kloss Equipment. Thursday and Friday action last week showed how much the grain futures were oversold. Temperatures already are warming back up, though, and combines are back in the fields across a wide area once again, so we look at support levels here early week. December corn should hold the 482 level. January soybeans, they're run to $13 short-lived, but again, sales off the combine will likely push that back to the 1280, 1282 level. Good support there. Kansas City December wheat showing 665 support. This is the bottom line report. A rancher from Alamosa, Colorado is a Super Bowl champion. The winner of the World Forage Super Bowl at World Dairy Expo in Madison, Wisconsin. His commercial hay entry topped 293 others. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day, a profitable week ahead.
Food security is national security.
Senate Ag Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow opening up a special hearing the other day to explore how foreign ownership of U.S. farmland and food-related companies might be a threat to national security, and if so, what to do about it. It's an interesting, controversial issue, and we'll hear more about it on this edition of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford. Opinions on the issue of foreign ownership of U.S. farmland and other ag-related businesses vary widely. Some say the amount of U.S. farmland owned by China, for example, is only 0.5% of all U.S. ag land owned by interests outside the U.S., and so that may not be a threat. Others, such as Montana's Senator John Tester, disagree, especially when it comes to specific countries.
When we're talking about the Chinese Communist Party putting up a corn milling plant within miles of a sensitive Air Force base, we need to make sure that this doesn't happen. Because quite honestly, China, Russia, Iran, North Korea, they are not friends of ours. They want to make us less than what we are today. So we shouldn't allow these bad actors to be on our soil. Honestly, the fact is that if they're there to have impacts on our food supply, that's bad business. If they're there to spy on us, they shouldn't be allowed to spy on us anywhere in the world, and certainly not on our own soil.
But USDA Deputy Undersecretary Gloria Montano-Green told lawmakers that while many people believe the U.S. Department of Agriculture should go ahead, just move in and tightly restrict foreign purchases of U.S. ag land, the fact is,
our authority does not allow us to stop the selling of foreign land. We do not have authority to have a decision in foreign or domestic land purchases and leases.
USDA does have the job of tracking and disclosing land deals, but the system for doing that is a complex patchwork.
There are more than 3,000 county clerks and recorders' offices, more than 50 state systems, and more than 500 sovereign tribal nations processing and tracking of land ownership and land transfer.
And this reporting process is still being done on paper. A few days ago, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack talked about this foreign investment issue with reporters at the White House.
Well, I think there's concern, as there was in the North Dakota circumstance, where the Chinese interest was purchasing land near a military installation. I think there's legitimate concerns in that space.
He said there are many angles to this issue, and he also said USDA has the job of tracking land ownership changes, but it's a very complex job, again, given the current system.
I would also say that I think there's work to be done to give us the tools to be able to do an even better job of ensuring that we know when these transactions take place. It's complicated, but every county has their county recorder. And on any given day, somebody may walk into that recorder's office and file a deed, and there's no way of knowing precisely whether or not that is a Chinese purchaser. We need to work on how we might be able to collect the information and be able to analyze that information in a timely way so that we would determine whether or not a threat exists or not.
And that is the big question to be answered in specific cases, but also in general. Meanwhile, foreign purchases of U.S. farmland are growing, but foreign holdings still amount to a small fraction of all U.S. farmland.
Currently, 3.1% of American agricultural land is foreign-owned. Contrary to popular belief, foreign governments don't typically own this land.
That's Dr. David Ortega with Michigan State University. He says most of the foreign-owned U.S. farmland is owned by business interests in Canada and Europe, not by governments, not by China. Dr. Ortega also says that many people believe foreign purchases of U.S. land are causing land prices to rise and become too expensive for small and mid-sized farmers to afford.
However, there is no clear evidence that foreign ownership is causing U.S. farmland prices to rise.
So, Dr. Ortega says right now Chinese ownership of U.S. farmland poses little threat to U.S. food security, but he does see a threat from the Chinese from another direction.
I would consider China's investments in agricultural research and technology one of the biggest threats to our food security. They are currently spending 5 times more on research and development today than they were 2 decades ago. In comparison, here in the U.S., our spending and investment has fallen, and it's fallen by about a third over the last 2 decades. And it is about half of what China is spending, and their trajectory is upward. We are falling behind, and it's what I would consider to be one of the most serious threats to our food security, is their level of investment.
Investments in agricultural science and technology, not necessarily in U.S. land. Although he says that is a growing sector, but right now it does not pose a major threat to the security of Agriculture USA. I'm Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
If your soil could talk, what would it say? If it's healthy, it may already be saying some good things about your future. Because farmers who use soil health building systems that include no-till, cover crops, and diverse species and rotations report greater productivity, profitability, and resiliency to weather extremes. Learn more about what your soil is saying about its health and your future. Contact your local USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service office today. This message brought to you by USDA and this radio station.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. USDA conducts several trade missions throughout the year to countries that present new and continued market opportunities. Today we hear a bit about the success from a recent trade mission to Chile. The U.S. has had relations with Chile for 200 years. USDA Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor recently led an ag business delegation, which included representatives from the food and ag sector and several agricultural commissioners. Here are some comments from their recent trip.
We are calling you from Santiago, Chile this afternoon. Here, I've been leading an agribusiness trade mission where we have over 35 U.S. businesses on our trade mission and at the Espacio Food and Beverage food and service show here in Santiago this week. Also, we have been joined on this mission with 11 agricultural associations and cooperators and four state departments of agriculture, who I will allow to introduce themselves here shortly. In addition to having our businesses meet with Chilean buyers, we also have brought in buyers from Peru and Ecuador to really be able to maximize what this region has to offer. This week, we've had an approximate 350 business-to-business meetings as part of the trade mission, and have heard nothing really but positive from our businesses about the interest from the importers and buyers that they've met with, the potential that they see in the Chilean market, and just a little bit about what this market looks like for our agricultural exporters. It is the third largest market for U.S. food and agricultural exports in South America, and we have strong bilateral trade with Chile. Bilaterally in the food and ag space, we are trading $8.5 billion in 2022. $1.1 billion of that is U.S. food and agricultural exports, with about 60% of those exports consumer-oriented products, high-value protein products like dairy, beef, pork, poultry. We also send quite a lot of condiments, and turns out the largest importer of U.S. beer in the world is Chile. Part of the reason we are here and picked Chile, besides what I have talked about, is that they have been a long-trusted partner, really a regional leader here in South America, and they have shared values with the United States, and they have a strong and stable economy, and so a really great opportunity for U.S. food and agricultural businesses who are interested in exporting to South America. It's a great market to do that in. So thank you for joining us today. We look forward to talking about what we've seen and done here on this trade mission. But before we open up to questions, I'd like to turn it over to my colleagues from the State Department of Agriculture who are here with me, and I'll start with Commissioner Goring.
Thank you, Undersecretary Taylor. It's been a wonderful trip. Doug Goring, North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner. I guess a few comments I would make. I think this has been a great opportunity to really work on the relationships, our rapport, and build a better understanding and appreciation for the Chilean culture, but also areas in where we can complement each other, given the fact that our growing seasons are opposite of each other. So there's been a lot to really absorb, and I think a great path forward.
Hi there, everyone. Kate Greenberg, Colorado Commissioner of Agriculture. I'd like to reiterate my colleague's thoughts here and thank Undersecretary Taylor and her team for an incredible mission here in Chile. I think a lot of the same experiences from Colorado's perspective, certainly seeing opportunities for us, for our Colorado producers, especially beef, dairy, beverages, consumer-facing products that we've seen the opportunities here, but also what we can take home and see as complementary from our Chilean partners as well. So great field visits, great government meetings, business to business, and a lot of good time spent talking ag across our two continents.
Good afternoon. This is Hillary Maracle, our commissioner said, but also just a great opportunity to really truly understand what our Chilean consumer is looking for and how we can serve their needs while continuing to build success with bilateral agreements.
Hi, everyone. This is Taylor Buckley from the International Marketing Team on the Missouri Department of Agriculture. We are blessed to have this opportunity to join on this ATM, and we're looking forward to see how our industries correlate with the Chilean government and the agri sectors down here as well.
This is the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search AgNet News Hour or AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
October 12th is National Farmers Day, a time dedicated to those who wake before the sun rises and often work until long after it sets. Thanks to farmers' tireless efforts, we have the food, feed, fiber, and fuel we need here in America and plenty more for export. Best of all, farmers produce all of this sustainably so that future generations can have the same bounty. Today and every day, please join Syngenta in honoring the men and women of American agriculture.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. AFT calling attention to farming on PBS. American Farmland Trust will sponsor the new PBS National Public series called America the Bountiful, with its premiere planned for spring of 2024. The new project is a food, history, and travel series exploring the regional food traditions of America's heartland. It will help viewers learn more about culture and find inspiration in the chronicles of farmers, artisans, restaurateurs, and home cooks through the bounty that they grow, produce, and eat. The show will shine a spotlight on the vibrant, culturally diverse, untold food stories and traditions hidden across America. AFT President and CEO John Pody says, quote, "We're focused on saving the land that sustains us all. And our new partnership with America the Bountiful will help us reach an important PBS audience of engaged and committed conservationists, farmers, and food lovers across the country. We're excited to further educate people about the importance of farmland protection and sound agricultural practices." NAFB contributed to that report.
Resistance issues are continuing to give rice growers problems when addressing weeds. Rice Farm Advisor Whitney Brim DeForest highlights some options for alternative cleanup sprays instead of doubling up on propanil.
We have the sort of standard Abolish and Regiment spray that has been around for a while. We know that that works on resistant watergrass, but, you know, not everyone likes it. It's pretty hot. And then I've been experimenting with propanil loyan tank mix, and that seems to be working pretty well. And then I recently found propanil shark tank mix works pretty well. And I'm doing more field work this year, so I should have results for people by December or so. And then the last one is the regiment followed by propanil. A lot of folks have been doing that for a while. So it's regiment and then followed by a propanil application a week later. And all of those have multiple modes of action. So it just discourages selection for resistance.
Growers with large populations of weeds that survive until the end of the season are encouraged to get them tested.
One of the best ways is to submit seed to the UC Weed Science Resistance Testing Program. Kasim Al-Khatib runs that up at the Rice Experiment Station. But I do ask usually that people ask for assistance if they're unsure how to collect. We want to make sure that the samples are good so that they get good germination and we get good results. So usually, you know, submissions should be happening roughly now through like October, maybe early November.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby talks about climate smart conservation practices and the partnership between landowners and NRCS technical staff to put such practices into action.
Most of our practices, some of them are standalone, but some of them work better when they're in conjunction with other things. Let's talk about cover crops. We've really focused on a lot of that, and we have really done well talking about let's get some type of cover on this ground and not leave it fallow. That has been pretty popular. When we talk about no-till farming, reducing the amount of inputs, reducing the amount of trips across the field. When you look at it, we talk about our grazing systems and going out and making sure you're productive as far as your cattle is concerned and having grass for them to eat. We have 175 different standards in our repertoire, and if you name it, we probably got it. And our professionals out there are the ones that come out and talk and say, hey, these are some recommendations we'd like to make, and what do you think about this? And sometimes the producer pretty much knows what they want to do. It's just refining it and talking and seeing how they will fit into some of these programs. And so it works pretty well with this one-on-one contact, this one-on-one discussion in the field with the producer, and then this becomes a long-term partnership.
And with more on that, here's USDA's Rod Bain talking with NRCS Chief Terry Cosby about signups that are underway for those two NRCS programs.
now being accepted at local USDA service centers. Fiscal year 2024 applications for two of the department's natural resources conservation programs, Environmental Quality Incentives Program and Conservation Stewardship Program.
We've made those funds available to our states, so EQIP and CSP. Folks should walk into our USDA office. We're having signups right now.
Natural Resources Conservation Service Chief Terry Cosby says in addition to EQIP and CSP signups focused on climate smart practices, applications for the current funding cycle for the Agricultural Conservation Easements Program are being accepted through November 13th, while sign-up for Regional Conservation Partnership Program funding opportunities is scheduled to take place early next year. Additional details are available online at www.nrcs.usda.gov. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
More crop insurance options for organic and specialty crop growers now. The USDA is improving crop insurance options for specialty crop and organic producers, including rolling out a new and expanded option based on feedback from America's producers. Risk Management Agency Administrator Marcia Bunger says, quote, "We're committed to working with specialty crop and organic producers to develop options that fit their needs. We listened to what they said and we're proud of our efforts to deliver crop insurance options that meet the needs of producers, as well as to share information on available crop options." From 1990 to 2002, liabilities for insured specialty crops rose from $1 billion to more than $23 billion. And over the past 20 years, the number of individual specialty crop insured under the crop insurance program grew by 27%. Currently, there are over 70 individual specialty crops insured under the crop insurance options. New insurance options include the Transitional and Organic Grower Assistance Program, as well as the Tropical Storm Coverage. NAFB contributed to that report.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.